Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Freedom Report podcast. Today's special guest, Lucy Steigerwald of Antiwar.com. She's also a writer for Rare and about a million other magazines. How many people do you write for, Lucy?
I write a weekly police column for Vice, and I'm hoping to get some new gigs in the future. And I have a blog that I neglect constantly, the Stag Blog.
The Stag Blog, that's right. So ladies and gentlemen, don't forget to check out the Stag Blog. Lucy Steigerwald's writing is all over the place. And her and I, we like to spar online sometimes every once in a while. We get our bloody knuckles and we're punching each other. But Lucy and I, we have a lot of things that we believe that are the same, and we have some differences of opinion. We're going to talk about that, but probably the most important thing that happened in Lucy's career recently, you became one of the top 20 hottest libertarian girls in the world. Lucy, how did you feel about that honor?
I am staring angrily at you right now, so that's part of it. I will say that I would much rather be on a podcast with you than being on your list, because I get to chat, and you just didn't sort of put me on the list. I was kind of annoyed by your list.
But didn't you share it? Didn't you share the list?
I did a little bit, and then I deleted it.
Oh.
And you gave me like 60 new blog likes on my Facebook page.
Yeah.
So it works. I will never deny that it works.
That's what it's all about. And you see, it wasn't about being disrespectful. It was about showcasing these beautiful women and their careers.
And you did. I did enjoy the fact that on your list you plugged my work to death and knew that I would still kind of want to kill you.
Yes.
That proved you were paying attention a little bit, so that's good.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so news of the day. You just got out of a very exciting, interesting talk. I mean, you were saying that you were feeling like crying. This was a speech from a survivor, an escapee from North Korea, the tyrannical regime of North Korea, Yeonmi Park. And can you tell us what the talk was all about, and how did it make you feel?
I missed, like the first couple of minutes. First, she kind of talked about black markets and how millennials in North Korea are known as the black market generation because, you know, movies just generate. She talked about Pretty Woman. Like, movies are slipping in there. Like, the whole perfect facade of the Kims as perfect leaders, no outside information, it's failing, you know, more and more. And people like her, they risk their lives or their, you know, decades of freedom to watch some stupid movie, which in itself is totally amazing. So she talked about black market stuff, and she talked about her father getting put in a work camp and how she and her mother fled. And it was just, you know, it was just like really emotional to see that on a million different levels, because North Korea, it's just, if it didn't exist, like a libertarian might invent it. It's just that, and it's this dystopian novel come to life, and it's really, what got me in particular was when she's talking about crossing the Gobi Desert with her mother to get to Mongolia so they can go back, all the way back to South Korea, where they'll be safe from being deported back to North Korea. And she was talking about how she was maybe going to die, but she didn't want to be forgotten. And there are a lot of people, just thinking about, like, there are a lot of people in North Korea and places like that where they're just
they die in the Gobi Desert.
And they're totally forgotten, yeah. If you're lucky, almost, you die in the Gobi Desert. If you die in some camp instead.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a related note, the film The Interview, which was released lately, was the subject of great controversy because ostensibly North Korean hackers might have hacked into a private company in the United States, Sony Pictures, which is, yes, it's a Japanese company, but the Sony film division is actually in the United States. So North Korean hackers ostensibly, you know, committed an act of cyber terrorism against a corporation here in the United States. What do you think would be an appropriate response to something like that?
Well, I think, as last I checked, it was still being debated as to the actual culprits. Mm-hmm. I'm not as up on, you know, cyber terrorism, which I know is the hot new thing to be afraid of, which makes me, you know, be cautious about, like, overhyping it as a threat. I mean, terrorism is a silly term. Cyber terrorism is sort of pushing it, terminology-wise. Obviously, it's not good if North Korea was actually doing that. I don't have a good answer for what to do about that sort of thing, you know.
Intellectual honesty, I appreciate
that. I mean, I don't, you know.
All right, yeah, well, so if, for example, an institution like the NSA has to exist, for the fact that you and I can't delete it today, even if we would like to. If that institution existed and solely was pointed at foreign threats such as this type of cyber terrorism, which is what I think it should be called, hacking into someone's private property, by a foreign government, then if the NSA only protected the United States against those threats and wasn't engaging in warrantless wiretapping and all of that, would that institution have any legitimacy?
At the end of the day, I'm an anarchist, but I do think it's important to practice putting on my minarchist hat and talk about, you know, what might be an improvement over now without getting, you know, even close to my ideal society. I think in theory, an NSA that only, you know, did conniving stuff abroad would be, I don't know. I mean, like, you want to say it would, in theory it would be an improvement if they were just focusing on things abroad, but the CIA is awful, and the CIA has been awful since their birth, and they've been, you know, staging coups all over the
world.
But
they killed Che Guevara. You can give them that, right?
Yeah, I actually had a great uncle I never met who apparently was in the CIA in South America around that time, so I like to, did my uncle, great uncle, kill Che Guevara? Perhaps he did.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the obviously the CIA is corrupt. It's, you know, the clandestine organization. They cause more trouble than they're worth. They seem to be almost actively working against us. They have a mandate not to operate within the United States, but we've seen many times that they do operate within the United States. But they do every once in a while get it right. When they killed Che Guevara. So, I mean, things like that. Is there ever credit when it's due? Is there ever credit due when it is?
No, I mean, like, for example, in theory, you know, I think it's ridiculous that war is sort of an acceptable thing, but assassination is sort of, you know, undignified, and like, that's not playing by the rules.
Right.
Sort of, you know, massive civilian casualties is okay, but sneaking around and just taking somebody out isn't.
Right.
But also, assassination has consequences that nobody can predict, especially the bureaucratic idiots who have been making the same mistake for decades. I mean, the CIA basically recently decided in, you know, I guess not unclassified, but that training, you know, foreign troops for various endeavors doesn't really work. Like, they know a little better than some of the bureaucrats who have certain ideas about what they should be doing. But at the end of the day, I don't trust any of them.
Totally. Well, you're not supposed to. I guess I want to get back to North Korea for a moment. You know, South Korea being, you know, sort of not a capitalist utopia, but certainly, you know, miles and above better than their northern comrades. Do you think that the United States should remove their troops from the DMZ?
Yes.
Okay, why?
Because they have no business being there.
Okay, why?
Because I think that U.S. troops should pull back everywhere.
Okay, but I mean, do the ends ever justify? Do the ends ever justify the means? I mean, in some sense, you know, if someone breaks into my house and I'm being held captive in the basement, and they break down somebody, you know, my front door and destroy that property, and they kill the bad guys, and then they free me from the basement, I don't really care that they had to destroy private property, or that they had to, you know, perhaps do, you know, use some bloody means in order to get to good ends. And what I'm saying is that the ends, meaning a free South Korea, appear to be a positive good in the world. It appears that what the United States did in that sense...
You mean the Korean War.
The Korean War.
Yeah.
Has had a positive benefit. Should the United States have just allowed the South Koreans to be overrun by communists, which is the antithesis of everything that you and I stand for?
I think that war was a mistake. I mean, you can look at a war and see some of the good ends that came out of it. I mean, the most easy example in the world is Hitler being dead was awesome. Like, the Holocaust not going any further than it did was awesome. But I do, you know, I'm not okay with Dresden, Hiroshima, and Nagasaki. And I do know that stopping the Holocaust, which is the best, you know, motivation maybe you could think of for a war, was not the real motivation. And the U.S., you know, knew about the camps very early. They didn't do anything until they helped to fund Raoul Wallenberg late in the game.
But why are motivations even important, Lucy? That's my real question, because,
well, because
it's like Lincoln freeing
the
slaves. Libertarians give Lincoln a hard time for engaging in a bloody civil war, and they say, well, he didn't care about freeing the slaves. But if you're a slave, you don't give a damn. If you're a South Korean, you don't give a damn. You're just happy to be
but
free.
But you can switch that around and say, you know, do you give a damn that the country bombing you, you know, has, like, domestically, those people are more free than you are. If your family dies, if you die, if you're injured, do you care? I mean, somebody might. I think I would be mad. My comparison I like to think about is if Amsterdam came to bomb us because of our horrifying drug policies. You know, I would be like, that's true, we do have those, but you also, you know, blew up my house. Like, it wouldn't satisfy me as an explanation for that kind of aggressive behavior.
But do the ends ever justify the means?
It's
because and the reason why I ask,
that's a vague question when you're talking about a national scale,
right.
And your metaphor of, you know, the rescuing the kidnapped victim is a variation on the sort of what if they broke into your house and raped your wife and you know tried to kill you. That individual self-defense, it does not translate to a national scale.
Really?
It's too complicated.
Really? So you think that people are not allowed to collectively bind together in order to provide for their own common defense?
No, that's different.
Okay.
You can do that. So a national scale, particularly on, right. on the largeness of the United States, geographically,
okay.
governmentally,
so
it's
too big.
So in order
to defeat the Japanese, it's too, what do you mean it's too big? So in order to defeat the Japanese, it required a national collective war effort.
Well, in retrospect, I mean, yes, there was such an effort, and the Japanese are gone. So in retrospect, you know, you can't prove, you know, now that it couldn't have happened some other way than the
sure,
way it happened.
Of course.
They're gone, and that's good, because they were scary, and Hitler was scary, and they're gone, and that's good. But it's not as clear-cut as that to me.
I want to talk about the nuclear bomb. We've discussed this. We've debated this. I know you and I disagree on this. I've waffled on it. And I've listened to both sides of you. Was it a good thing to drop the bomb? Was it a bad thing to drop the bomb? And, you know, everybody agrees that the Holocaust was a bad thing. I don't think anybody would say that if we had dropped the bomb on Berlin, probably people would have felt less bad about it because of the Holocaust. But when we dropped it on Imperial Japan...
The rape of Nanking. It's comparable enough to make
comparable
that...
Comparable enough to the rape of Nanking. So here's the thing. The Japanese were killing about 100,000 civilians and prisoners of war every month that the war was going on towards the end of the war. Now, the amount of...
check on that, but...
Yeah, please do. Please do. Across all of their colonies, the entire Japanese empire at the end of the war, please double check. Almost 100,000 civilians and prisoners of war were being killed. Bataan Death March, et cetera, et cetera. And so... You know, we're talking about ends justifying the means. It seems to me to have been a small price to pay. And I know that for the people who died in it, they're not going to feel the same way. But for the 100,000 civilians who could be saved, it somewhat strikes me as just a bit, relative sometimes, the decisions that have to be made by policymakers on whose lives are important and whether or not, you know, why should we feel bad about killing 100,000 Japanese civilians?
You should at least feel bad.
Well, I feel bad about it, but I feel less bad about it because the simple fact that they started it. And
the civilians did not start it.
No, well, it doesn't matter. They're responsible for the government. They're responsible for
were
the government.
Were the children responsible for the government?
No, but their parents...
Be precise. If you're going to do this, be
certainly,
precise.
Certainly. But if they want to be precise, then the parents have a responsibility to evacuate.
Sure.
Meaning, like, those people in North Korea who are trying to escape right now, they've taken it upon themselves not to have a revolution of government, but to understand that they cannot move the mountain, that they need to move away from the mountain.
And that's good.
And at some point, like, you have to, on an individual level, the parents have to take some sort of responsibility for that. Hey, our government is Nazis. You know, we don't give the same credit to the Germans. We beat the hell out of a lot of civilians in Germany because they were standing near the concentration camps and they did nothing. So why does that not apply to the same to the Japanese civilians who stood by and did nothing as they raped Nanking and as they had sneak attacked on Pearl Harbor?
It's a lot to address there. I'm not going to say that the Holocaust was, you know, particularly worse than Nanking. I don't know as much about Nanking. One could argue that the Holocaust was easier to see with German civilians. You might note, you probably should notice if your neighbors are being rounded up and there's graffiti on the Jewish storefront and that sort of thing.
Unless you're a non-interventionist, in which case it's none of your business.
I'm glaring at Austin right now. I would not argue that it's none of my business. I'm sorry. What exactly?
What I'm saying is
Japan and Nazi Germany.
Yes, this is that they are at least relatively comparable. That dropping the nuclear weapon on Berlin would not have been seen as any sort of war crime, but that it has been seen as a war crime on the Japanese, mostly because I think people have a false perception of what the Imperial Japan really constituted, which is war crimes as horrific and even worse in many cases than the Nazis.
I think it's really fair to say we should remember how bad that government was in Imperial Japan. I think that's totally fine. I would not be okay with nuking Berlin. Berlin was... Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they were a lot more civilian-based. Nagasaki in particular was a last-minute, inclusion. That's pretty brutal and pretty... If we're talking about nuking a whole city.
But it's not precise. You know what I mean? It's not like assembly line.
That's part of the problem.
Right.
That's part of the whole problem.
Right.
But also, you have
That's why we have drones now.
The firebombing of Dresden. You have the firebombing of Tokyo.
Sure.
The nuke is horrific because somebody immediately opened up the can of worms and, you know, two cities were actually nuked with this new terrifying weapon. It's very iconic. Fundamentally, it's not worse than what was done to Dresden or Tokyo. It
right.
simply is dramatic, and one bomb did it, and that sort of
right.
thing.
Well, that's intellectually
it's the
honest.
Same animal.
Exactly. Exactly. So that's why I don't really get, my panties in a wad over the use of a nuclear weapon versus a drone, because to me, you know, killing is killing in many ways.
Well, you need thousands of bombs to equal a nuke. So
you would. And so...
That's comparable.
I mean, you know, rightly libertarians are skeptical of the use of drones, but arguably a drone is certainly more tactical than a nuclear weapon.
It certainly is.
It seems to be an improvement in terms of war, but it still carries with it some problems. But to me, it's like when it comes to, you know, self-defense, national defense, I mean, how responsible is someone for a civilian getting in the way of your own self-defense? Now, I've debated with Anthony Gregory on this, and we've had a debate of if A attacks C and uses B as a human shield, can C shoot at A if that means that he's going to hit B, right? And so Anthony Gregory's theory is that, yes, C can attack A to stop himself from being aggressed upon, but if he harms B, then he owes recompensation to B, right? So do you think that in like an American Sniper-style situation, a Chris Kyle situation, where a woman is perhaps standing in between an enemy sniper or an enemy soldier, and if Chris Kyle hits her in order to protect his soldiers, that he should have some sort of recompensation for her and her family?
That sounds like a start, yeah. I mean, in that situation...
There should be no laws to protect soldiers in that kind of a sense. Even if they're defending their own lives and of their own friends, you can...
I'll just be very clear. I'm not interested in, you know, soldiers getting killed. I know a lot of people who were soldiers who I really, really like. But fundamentally, the fact that U.S. soldiers shouldn't have been there and weren't even drafted to be there. They signed up for an organization that sent them there, and I'm sorry if they didn't, you know, think that was going to happen.
A priori.
I have less sympathy. They shouldn't have been there, so my sympathy tends to err on the side of the civilians. I'm not saying that I'm going to deny the humanity of the soldiers or anything, or that I want them to die either, but I'm going to err on the people, side of the people who may have, you know, wildly different beliefs than I do, but fundamentally, you know, an invading army came to where they live. And I'm sympathetic to,
The problem with that argument is that many of the people that we were fighting at the insurgents were invaders themselves, meaning that they were not locals.
That's a fair point, sure.
So, all right, let's talk about ISIS. President Obama sought an authorization for the use of military force. Actually sounds pretty damn libertarian in a sense, because he's asking for a moratorium after 3 years on this authorization of military force, not tying his hands to make war, but what he's done effectively is introduced democratic deliberation into the process, sort of like what we do with the Patriot Act, in meaning that when his predecessor comes in, that there will have to be a debate in the Congress about whether or not the president continued to make war against ISIS. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's a little embarrassing that the executive branch feels that magnanimous. Oh, I'm going to actually ask Congress. Oh, what a revelation about making war. I mean, that's how low we've sunk. Much like the drone thing, like drones are in many ways an improvement. I'm doing finger quotes right now. But, you know, a drone is also a very cheap way to have a presence in a foreign country. Basically permanently, where war has not been declared. They freak out civilians, and they've killed civilians. You know, their targeting is not precise.
You think we should declare war on ISIS? Is that correct?
No,
I mean, if we were
going
to go to battle with them, that we should declare war.
I have a moral objection to war, but I have seen nothing wrong with throwing up, you know, tactical, practical hindrances, you know.
Such as
Congress, you know, not the executive branch. Just any kind of I'm not a constitutionalist, I'm more radical than that. Any kind of hindrance to the war process, we should use all of that just to throw it in front of the war machine.
Okay, but when you say, so what do you mean when you say that? So when you talk about hindrance, I mean, like, when ISIS has declared war against the United States, okay, they've murdered journalists, children, Christians, and they would love for us to declare war against them officially, because it would, in a sense, be legitimizing them as a state. Now, as libertarians, we don't like states. And so, you know, declaring war against them would, in a sense, be granting them more legitimacy than they've earned. So if someone has declared war against us, do we have any legitimacy to in defending ourselves by returning fire in any sense? She looks conflicted, folks.
No, I'm just sort of baffled by the way you have phrased that. Yeah, I'm a little draggy this afternoon.
I'm not a bad
writer. So, we're asking about ISIS.
Yeah, we're talking about ISIS. Are we allowed to defend ourselves against that form of threat? And if so, in what manner?
Well, they're not... I mean, they haven't come here. They're not at the gates of the U.S.
That's not true, because we've had a threat. There was an ISIS-inspired terrorist who was going to attack Congress who was arrested just recently.
All right. Well, I mean, this is the internal problem with the war on terror and the decentralized actors and the potential for, you know, a lot of people, if they want to act in the name of ISIS and do something terrible in the United States, you know, in the middle of Nebraska or somewhere totally unforeseen, they could do it. And, you know, maybe ISIS would be very pleased. Like, this is the danger. States, as bad as they are, you know, it's more convenient in certain ways fighting them. Because you at least sort of have, you know a bit more about who you're fighting.
If ISIS were to make a threat, a 9/11 style threat against the United States, how should we defend ourselves against something like that?
A threat, not an actual act.
Yeah, well, a threat. I mean, and they obviously are planning. I mean, in anarcho-capitalism land, there is no CIA or intelligence agencies telling us what they're doing, so we have no idea. We only know that, you know, most likely these guys are going to bomb us because, you know, word of mouth and internet threats, because there's no other, there's no intelligence capability, unfortunately. So in your world, Lucy, knowing that there may be another 9/11 style bombing from a terroristic government, the Islamic State, if they are allowed to become a state, how could we defend ourselves in your ideal world?
Well, the nice thing about terrorists, take that out of context.
Take that out of
yes.
Cut.
Is that they're pretty bad at their jobs. 9/11 was a staggering anomaly in terms of success. It's still amazing to realize how what they managed to do. In the years since then, we've had a lot of terrorist attacks.
Are you downplaying these threats, Lucy?
Yes, I am.
1993 World Trade Center bombing, the bombing of our embassies.
Two people died.
Benghazi. I mean, how many people died in Benghazi?
Four, I think.
Yeah, and one of our ambassadors.
Yeah.
And now we're evacuating Yemen because of the threats.
I'm not going to say we should go to war because four people died at an embassy. I mean, that's...
How many people need to die?
It just doesn't work that way, Austin.
My problem with a pure anti-war anarchist position is that I believe that it does not even account for self-defense. You've even sort of identified in a sense as a pacifist. That's perfectly fine, Lucy.
I'm not a pacifist. I'm close. Okay. I'm in the neighborhood, let's say.
Okay, it's perfectly fine. And I would never say that you're not a libertarian because you're a pacifist. However, pacifists would say that someone who believes in a more aggressive self-defense posture would say that's not libertarian. And the reason why I disagree with that is because I think that it ties our hands from actual self-defense, from things like preemptive strikes, which preemptive literally means to come before something, meaning that the non-aggression principle says you must be aggressed upon before you can actually defend yourself.
Right.
Right? Well, the problem with that is that when someone points a gun at you, they have not necessarily committed an act of aggression because there's no harm being done. But if someone points a gun at me, I think everyone can assume that I have the right to kill that person, even though there has been no violence done at me, no physical violence or aggression. So what I'm trying to do is to equate this to the situation with ISIS by saying that they're pointing the gun at us. Okay, and if you even, let's say, for argument's sake, please give me the fact that they're pointing a gun at us. You may disagree, but let's just for the sake of this conversation, if they are pointing a gun at us, how can we defend ourselves? How are we allowed to defend ourselves in your world? You're not pacifist, but almost world.
Well, Lord. Fundamentally, self-defense. I'm not a pacifist, you know, like the
Quakers and Amish and stuff.
Right, like if someone directly attacks you, you can respond in kind. If you attack an invisible person right here, like I can step in and try to help them. That kind of self defense is okay.
I think not on a national level.
Some circumstances, if you're holding a gun and you know, I can maybe preemptive in a very broad sense. You know, if you're threatening people with a gun, there's a circumstances where that could apply. It does not translate on a national scale because of the lack of knowledge, because of the lack of consent, and because of the absolutely inherent problem, which is going to be the civilian casualties, lack of knowledge, unpredictable blowback, and long-term power vacuums if you're assassinating someone. Fundamentally, the government and, you know, CIA, NSA, military-type people, some are a little better at certain things than others, but they don't know what is going to happen when they do something.
Would you trust a free market institution to provide defense against the Islamic State, something like a Blackwater?
I have a problem with Blackwater in the way that I have a problem with private prisons. They're not really private, and they do some coercive things. I think in theory, a private defense agency can be a good thing, but you can have some of the same problems if they're aggressing somewhere.
But wearing your minarchist hat for a moment, would you support the hiring of mercenaries over using SEAL Team 6 and at this moment to defend ourselves from a posited threat from ISIS?
Mercenaries, maybe. Yeah, I mean, think about the killing of Bin Laden.
Beautiful stroke. Well done, right?
Like, you know, bless Ron Paul's heart, and I also think that, like, you know, if you had captured Bin Laden as a prisoner, that would have been fine.
Much better.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
You could have interrogated him, etc.
Fundamentally, it's not top of my list of things to object to, is the way that Bin Laden was killed. It's
right.
Not top of my list.
Right.
What happened in the decade before that, between that and 9/11, was two wars.
Right.
And hundreds of thousands of dead civilians. I mean, I realize it took a while to find Bin Laden. I'm not sure why it took exactly that long. But, like, they had to have two boots on the ground wars before they did the, you know, semi-legitimate in a minarchist hat sort of way action.
What is it that you think motivates people like ISIS to kill?
All of their propaganda is showing them to be, like, they appear to be, you know, some of the worst people in the world.
Okay, but what do you think it is that it motivates people like ISIS to kill?
Their interpretation of their religion, a very warped interpretation. I'm not religious, but I know that you can use religion for lovely things or very awful things. I think that, blowback, it's part of it is blowback. Part of it is what happens when you intervene and you antagonize people and you create, you know, power vacuums and you create more extreme offshoot of Al-Qaeda. What actually motivates them every day? God only knows. I mean, they're awful.
So if religion plays a part, then it's not going to be just bombs and guns that are going to solve these problems. We're going to have to actually combat bad ideas with good ideas. Now, you would agree, right?
In theory? I mean,
right.
That sounds okay.
That's a very generality. Now, I'd like to narrow this down. I think that the problem has to do with their ideology and their philosophy. And, G. Gordon Liddy had this hilarious statement that I only somewhat agree with, where he said, you can't kill an idea, but you can kill everyone who holds that idea.
Right.
And it's sort of funny, but in a sense, you know, I would rather fight ISIS from the ideological struggle. But that requires boldness in our speech. It requires people, like when Thomas Paine, after the revolution occurred, he wrote a book called The Age of Reason, which was an attack on the church, an attack on Christianity. And it's very popular right now for us to attack Christians, and very easy to do so, and it's much less to do so to attack radical Islam. One, I think, because they'll effing kill you, like they showed with the attacks on Charlie Hebdo, and two, because you're painted as an Islamophobe. Now, that can be leveled at people who criticize Judaism, and they say you're anti-Semite. However, I think that a problem nowadays is that anyone who attacks their ideologically, which I do from a fundamental standpoint and from a secular standpoint, because I think inherently collectivist groupthink in the religious sense is almost always inherently dangerous. Sorry to offend all my religious listeners, which I just did, but too bad. They know where I stand. But how do we fight that ideology without being seen as Islamophobic? And what's wrong with being Islamophobic? I mean, wouldn't you be, of course, terrified of a philosophy that says, you know, put women in a burqa, cut off people's heads, and, you know, isn't it sort of like how do we fight Islam as a radical philosophy, one of wanton murder and of misogyny and chauvinism and hatred? How do we fight it without becoming the barbarians that we despise?
Again, I will say, like, you could argue, and I know people who do this, that, you know, and this is a super atheist perspective that I don't quite share, that, you know, the horrible ISIS-type people are the true Muslims, again, finger quotes, and, like, the moderate people are interpreting it wrong. And even if that were true, there are hundreds of millions of Muslims in the world who are not ISIS and have no interest in being ISIS. ISIS is killing Muslims as well.
Sure.
I mean, we shouldn't forget that part. I would say that, I mean, in the world, extremist interpretations of Islam is a problem, but Islamophobia, as imprecise as a term that is also a problem. I think that in the United States, we tend to forget that people in the Middle East are people, that there are a lot of moderate people who mostly want to live their lives. You know, I'm not crazy about burqas. I'm never going to pretend to be. But I also, you know, I don't want France and the outlawing of that kind of thing. I think you should just, I mean, let people decide. I know it's easy to say that.
Thing is, I feel like there's just this moral cowardice in the world to confront these radicals, and that people are too afraid of offending people.
Well, this is sort of a sick. It has a parallel with sort of mainstream liberalism, in that we're afraid to say certain things, but we're not afraid to bomb the hell out of various places. As if, you know, being mean about religion might be
as bad as bombing the hell out.
Right. I mean, and like, I don't know. Like, I'm not religious, but I don't. Religion is so mixed up with life, and, you know, maybe resentment at the U.S. or not, or maybe total sadism if you're a certain type of ISIS person. Like, I think it's very difficult, and I don't think that we can separate. And even with Charlie Hebdo, where they were obviously targeting, you know,
free speech.
They were. But they also, you know, pragmatically picked, like, what are we going to be terrorists, like, what are we going to target? And you can't take that decision out of the context of France being very secular, of the West being aggressive in the Muslim world. It's all sort of entangled. And I can't untangle it, and I don't believe that various governments can.
Should we resist the desire for certain Islamic people instituting Sharia law within the United States? Because France actually has Sharia law zones. Should we resist that kind of push against our constitutional values, which maybe you don't agree with, but which we do have? Rights to free speech. There's some of these things which would be suspended in certain zones within the United States. Should we resist that?
The sort of right-wing paranoia that comes with that kind of question. I don't know.
It's not right-wing paranoia because
truth.
I'm not right-wing and I'm not paranoid.
No, I realize you're not right-wing. Yes.
But I do, because those zones do exist in liberal countries such as France. Now, they had to chase those Charlie Hebdo attackers to those zones where those radicals came from. So what I'm asking you is should we resist those kinds, the kinds of pushes for Sharia law in the United States? I'm not terrified that they're going to take over Texas or Michigan or whatever,
right,
or something like that. But what I do, am opposed to is the idea that there would be any sort of law that would go against our secular, liberal, classical liberal values that we have here in the United States. So should we resist that if that were to be attempted?
I mean, I think a good comparison is, say, fundamentalist Mormon groups and certain other groups where you're kind of coercing people when you raise them up in something as strict as, say, fundamentalist Islam, talking Warren Jeffs, forcing a 14-year-old to get married type thing.
Right.
This libertarianism, it gets a little tough because you're talking about technically sort of not government, but, and you know, parents maybe not own their children, but sort of rent them, and the state doesn't own them, and all that sort of thing. But they're so obviously coercing when you're raising them in that kind of environment.
Right.
I think that's sort of comparable, and I think it's a doozy.
Right, but if they want to secede, which libertarians are like secession all the time.
Right.
If Warren Jeffs wants to secede and create a compound, you know, what's his name, David Koresh in Waco or something. If they want to secede and have their own little utopia where they rape little children and they, you know, they subjugate their wives, et cetera, should they be allowed to do so within the borders of the United States? Proper.
I don't know. well, I think we probably shouldn't, you know, burn down their compound and then talk about how awesome the federal law enforcement is.
Agreed.
That's an interesting question. I think secession is generally, I mean, but no, sorry, here's an easy thing. I mean, we could take it to the Civil War.
I was getting ready to do that, but go ahead.
Okay, good.
Go ahead.
I mean, you know, in theory, and I don't like Lincoln. He's not my least favorite president. That's probably FDR or Wilson.
Hey, hell yeah, all right. I fist bump you, but my hands are all torn up. Go ahead.
So, I mean, the Civil War, like, it wasn't about slavery. I mean, several of those states said it very explicitly.
These are states' rats.
I mean, like, we want, you know.
Lincoln
was
a tyrant.
It was the state's right to be a slave state, I mean, as it were.
Exactly, right.
I love the Spooner interpretation of the Civil War, where sort of everyone's wrong. Slavery is one of the wrongest things that's ever been done.
Right.
But I also, if you're some, you know, poor white dude, and again, if the federal troops roll in the way they did to Baltimore and they arrested the mayor and they, you know, there were cannons still pointing at Baltimore and stuff, because Maryland wanted to go slave and they were sort of waffling on it, you know, the feeling of resentment when those troops rolled in is an understandable one. This is getting a bit tangential, but the whole idea was
secession for the purpose of...
Right, and secession with the goal being something unpleasant, which is the right to choose slavery. We've been through this question, and the way we tackled it, unfortunately, was, yay, slavery is gone. But, you know, the federal government absolutely became stronger. So, I mean, there's a trade-off we're talking about. That's...
Yeah, well, because, I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, sometimes conservatives especially, not as much libertarians, they are skeptical of federal power, right? And they think that local government is always better. But sometimes local government can be as tyrannical as federal government. And that's why we have the system of checks and balances such
right.
as we do. And initially, the Bill of Rights actually wasn't incorporated into the states.
Right.
And so it was that if the states wanted to take away your free speech right, or if the state wanted to set up a state church, or if the state wanted to take away your guns or something, then it could. It was only the federal government that couldn't. So I would argue that, you know, after the Civil War, that yes, the federal government got stronger, but it also gave us the 14th Amendment,
mm-hmm.
which has offered us the equal protections and immunities. And so, in a sense, the federal government has acted, they've obviously acted, you know, far beyond their power in many ways. They're very strict, limited powers. I also think that states don't have rights, that states only have powers, and then that's an important...
I would agree with that, yes.
That's an important distinction. But that the concept of secession in and of itself, in actual context of the United States today, is number one, not feasible, number two, actually wrong, and the reason why is because I say that in the modern context, perhaps the state of Jefferson, if Northern California wanted to break off and do that, they probably should do it, because the Southern Californians are nothing like the Northern Californians. However, in order to secede, you're also necessarily coercing all the other citizens of your state if they don't want to secede.
It's the eternal, I mean...
But here's the thing. If you don't like it, get out. Libertarians don't like this philosophy, but I think it's actually...
It makes us think of the Vietnam War.
It does, but it's actually not a bad philosophy, because it's basically saying... If you don't like it here, you should secede. Meaning, don't try and force everyone else in your state to go with you. Pack up your shit and get out. Meaning,
where
go
to?
Secede. Another state, another country. Here's the thing: the world is big, and there are plenty of places. You know, if you like socialism, you can go to Norway and Sweden. You have options. If you really love government, you can move to North Korea. And I'm saying, and I said, that's funny. You know, it's a joke. But the reality is that libertarians, they always talk about secession and states' rights, but I think it hides an agenda, a conservative agenda of states, of claiming that states should have powers that will give them just as much tyranny, make them just as tyrannical as the federal government is.
Yeah, I mean, somewhere like Texas and California, they're humongous. They're bigger than many countries in the
right.
world. So
you think if Texas seceded, that it would be a libertarian state? No, there would probably there would be twice as many
free guns, and they'd kill you for pot.
Exactly.
I mean, I think you're right that secession is very complicated, and you would have to worry about consent of people. I will say that you don't seem as worrying about people consenting to war as you are seem to be about consenting to secession.
That's true, but the problem is that one is an act of defense and the other one is an act of defiance.
In complete theory, is war an act of defense? not in practice lately.
In theory, right. It's true. I will give you that. Again, I'm not, you know, I'm not some militarist, but the thing is I want to engage in these thought exercises, and I sometimes will wear a neocon hat like you wear a minarchist hat, because so many neocons have influenced me with arguments from a libertarian perspective. Todd Seavey, perfect example.
Oh, don't use my love of Todd Seavey against me.
Oh, no, we're going to talk about Todd Seavey, because Todd Seavey, he blew my mind when we were working together. He was a writer for The Judge.
That's right, yeah.
And he said, I'm sort of a libertarian neocon. And I'm like, well, what do you mean?
Oh, Todd.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Neocon is sort of the preferred pejorative that we like to use in the liberty world. There's anyone who believes in self-defense is a neocon, I think. That's me being hyperbolic.
Yes, thank you.
But I do think that some pacifists are so militantly pacifist as to be a bit retarded. No offense. And so what I want to say here is Todd's idea of libertarianism is such that if we don't believe, if he called himself an anarchist libertarian neocon, all right?
Oh, meaning that's awful.
meaning no national borders, right? So Here's the thing. If we're an anarchist, we don't believe in national borders, okay? And if the ends sometimes justify the means, and then things like this, having American soldiers on the DMZ is protecting capitalism, defending, it's making the world safe for democracy is arguably a universal good, because where people can consent to their rulers. Hold on. Todd's argument was that liberty is a universal concept. It's not held here in the United States only by Americans, and that South Koreans deserve liberty as much as Americans do.
Of course they
and
do.
And so his argument is that if the United States stepped in and is protecting the South Koreans from the menace of the communist North, then that is a good thing. And even if they've used questionable means, that the ends were libertarian ends. And how would you argue with Todd Seavey on that? Tell everybody how much you hate Todd Seavey.
Todd Seavey is really nice and I like him, and we talk about space aliens sometimes.
You would never say that kind of nice thing about me, and yet I hold nothing but a similar opinion.
I don't know you as well in real life. We'll work on
that.
Good
point. All right.
You know, it's one of those things that sounds good in theory and gets really tough in practice. You don't have perfect knowledge and you don't know the consequences of actions. Absolutely everyone deserves liberty, but can we give it to them and how? I mean, that's
but should we
the
respect
question.
National sovereignty? Why should we respect national sovereignty? We don't even believe in states. I mean, screw North Koreans and their national sovereignty. Screw anyone's national sovereignty. If they attack us from Afghanistan, or if they attack us from wherever. I mean, George Bush, in a sense, is arguing that when he articulates that the war on terror is universal, and we will, you're either with us or the terrorists, and we will go into any country in order to stop them. It's something that we revile from a knee-jerk perspective.
But from a theoretical, logical
perspective, he's right. What do borders matter? Why should you respect sovereignty?
It's not about sovereignty. It's that in Iraq, it's not that, you know, borders are so precious. It's that a bunch of people who lived in the area known as Iraq got American troops pouring in, and hundreds of thousands of them died.
So whose responsibility was it to take out Saddam?
I need you.
It wasn't, because the consequence is what we see today in Iraq.
Okay, but yeah, so
he was an awful man.
So the ends were awful, and it got us ISIS. But in the case of Korea, the ends were good.
I'm not sure how many people died in the Korean War.
Oh, no.
Korean War, that's not my strong point in that.
But you see what I'm saying? I mean, these are the problems when we start talking about, when you say you're an anarchist and you say you believe in self-defense, well then why should, it becomes...
Isn't it time for them to leave, however?
What, the DMZ?
It's been 60 years.
I think it's time to leave when North Korea falls.
Well, here's to that day happening soon.
Well, here's the thing. Why don't we just send in a few drones and take out Kim Jong-un and his associates? I mean, theoretically, wouldn't there be
that's more tempting there than in most places.
Yeah.
Anytime, I mean, yeah.
Statist.
The desire to kill members of the Kim family is not a statist desire. The question is what to do with that desire.
Yeah, how do we... Yeah,
I'm not going to do anything.
The question
don't
is what
hack
means.
Me, North Korea.
Exactly. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you enjoy this fantastic discussion between my good friend Lucy Steigerwald. Please list off where can people find you. If they want to get the maximum benefit and find out and read more about Lucy and her fascinating points of view, where should people go first to find you? Where do you want people to go to click to say like?
My Twitter is good.
What's your Twitter?
Lucystag. Lucy Stagg.
Go to Twitter, Lucy Stagg, and she's got the Stagg blog,
mm-hmm.
and she writes for some. You've been writing for almost everybody. Rare, you know, American Conservative. I think you've written for them too.
I've never done American Conservative. I would love to write for them someday.
Oh,
I like them.
They're a good magazine. I'm
Vice, Rare, and Anti-War is kind of my standby.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's Lucy Staggerwald. Check her out at Lucy Stagg on Twitter, and check out her Stagg blog. Lucy, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you, Austin.